Good morning. Beautiful sunny morning in Park City. This is Larry Warren along with Doug Wells, and it's Monday morning, so that means it's time for Mountain Money.
And Larry, we finally got a sunny morning on Monday.
Yeah, it's been rainy and snowy, and this week is all sunshine. Looks like almost all sunshine all the way through Friday. So chance of showers on tomorrow.
The folks in town for spring break skiing, this is as good as it gets.
Absolutely, and it was terrific Sunday. At least I was out, and it was perfect.
Well, it's the Park City advantage. I was telling you in the green room ahead of time, I have some friends in town, and they went to Alta, and apparently the snow is not as good as it is on this side of the Wasatch.
Well, let's keep that rumor going. Okay, well, let's talk about this morning's show. First, we're going to talk to Tara Nicole Nelson, and Tara is a Silicon Valley veteran and marketer, worked for companies such as Under Armour and other software companies is what I mean to say. And she has discovered an audience of consumers and has articulated who they are and how to reach them in a book called The Transformational Consumer. So we'll be talking to Tara Nicole in just a minute.
Yeah, and for folks that are wondering, Under Armour in Silicon Valley and what's the connection, there's a very popular app called MyFitnessPal that Under Armour purchased, and that is where our author worked and why she's at Under Armour now or was at Under Armour. So I used to use the app quite frequently, and I know it's very popular here in Park City as well. So probably some interesting stories on that app and kind of the impact it's had, the positive impact on people's lives. And then we're going to go back here local. We've got Stephen Hooker. He's coming in studio, and he is with Cushman and Wakefield Commerce. Larry, rumors in town is that the commercial real estate space is getting very, very tight. So it's going to be interesting to hear from him.
Exactly. Yeah, lots of changes on Main Street of ownership of buildings, and it's hard to find a for rent sign in this town.
And then our final guest is going to be a young entrepreneur. His name is Blaine Ferrer. He lives, I believe it's in Lehigh, just on the other side of the Wasatch. And he has developed an app as well. It's called WeVite. And it's for messaging large groups without driving them nuts with those multiple replies that go back and forth. So you're listening to Mountain Money on KPCW. Please stay tuned. We'll be back in a minute.
This is Allison Kulo with the Park City Chamber Bureau. Joining the Chamber Bureau provides your business with benefits from lodging projections, educational videos, group sales leads, and a listing on the top travel site for Park City, and much more. Becoming a member of the Park City Chamber Bureau is a great investment for your business. Information on joining can be found at visitparkcity.com or call us at 649-6100. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit organization and KPCW supporter.
Mountain Money on KPCW is sponsored in part by Columbus Pacific Properties, introducing Apex Residences, 63 ski-through community residences located at Park City's expanded Canyon Village, with clubhouse amenities, heated outdoor pool, and in-house concierge. Information at apexparkcity.com.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. We have on the line with us now Tara Nicole Nelson from the Bay Area. She boasts a master's degree and a law degree from Cal Berkeley, and has been working as former vice president of marketing for MyFitnessPal, which is part of Under Armour, and is now the CEO of Transformational Consumer Insights. Welcome to Mountain Money.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You bet. I want to congratulate you. I think you have about the longest name, longest subtitle for a book we've dealt with yet. The Transformational Consumer, subtitle, Fuel a Lifelong Love Affair with Your Customers by Helping Them Get Healthier, Wealthier, and Wise. So,
well, there's a little backstory to that, which is that when I got this book deal, everyone said people buy books still, but they don't read them. So I just decided I would put most of my whole, you know, my whole point in the subtitle.
Yeah. Let's try to dig a little deeper, like maybe to page one.
All right. Let's do that.
Well, the transformational consumer. This is a subcategory of the general marketplace. How do you describe or define this consumer?
Yeah, I mean, we actually did an original survey of 2,000 U.S. customers as I was writing this book, and the data showed that 50% of them actually qualified as transformational consumers. So just as we get started talking about who the transformational consumer is, the big thing to keep in mind is that this is not a niche. This is about 50% of U.S. customers at this point in time. So in the way I define the transformational consumer is that they're this massive and growing group of people who view all of life as a series of projects to change their own behavior for the healthier, wealthier, and wiser. They know that if they can, they believe strongly that they can change anything about their lives if they can get a handle on their own behavior, but they know that behavior change is hard. So they're out there constantly looking for what are the new tools and technologies and apps and products and services and even content online that can help them make these hard to make behavior changes. So they tend to be early adopters. They tend to be very influential on the buying behavior of the people around them. They tend to be deeply loyal for a very long period of time to the brands and products and content that help them actually successfully make changes in their lives. And I joke that people who, if you've ever been both like vegan and paleo at different points in your life, which are kind of opposite food philosophies, you're probably a transformational consumer. Entrepreneurs are transformational consumers.
You know, like you, my daughter went to Berkeley, and yeah, she went into Berkeley a vegetarian and came out a carnivore, which would be the opposite of most people going to Berkeley, I would think.
Well, you might think, but you know, the thing is that in the zeitgeist of trying on new food philosophies in an effort to live healthier, both of those, you know, approaches have actually been very popular in the last, you know, 10, 20 years.
Well,
it's a little bit of like a case study in how experimental transformational consumers actually are.
Yeah. And I presume just by the things they do, the places they go for information, transformational consumers are generally younger than the population as a whole.
You know what's interesting is we found them all across the spectrum of age, all across the spectrum of geography, all across the spectrum of gender, and even of income. But the way it shows up in different groups is very different. And so, like, one thing that's a big sort of overarching theme of the book is that our aspirations, if you're trying to understand what someone will buy or what they will read or open, much more important for you to understand their aspirations, who they want to be, than their demographics, right? Than who they are now, what their age is. These things, age, gender, ethnicity, they don't limit transformational consumers the way that they did maybe 50 or more years ago. Now, with sort of the internet and technology, people of all ages are able to really play out and walk out their bias toward action to change their lives.
So
one example that I give of that is like my own purchasing behavior is I'm a 41-year-old Black woman who lives in the Bay Area. My own purchasing behavior is much more like that of a 60-year-old white man who lives in New York City, who also goes to spin class 6 times a week and also owns his own business and also has some of the other healthier, wealthier, wiser aspirations that I have, than another 41-year-old Black woman who lives here and doesn't have the same sort of aspirations that I have. The big takeaway here is aspirations matter much more than demographics when you're trying to engage consumers.
Yeah, I think to the extent you can engage people in who they want to become, you're going to be much more likely to capture their attention. The challenge is
keep it over time.
Well, but the challenge is getting them in the door to begin with, right? So demographics, you know, the nice thing about demographics is there's all kinds of data sources to make it easy to target those folks. How do businesses, and we have a lot of businesses here in Park City that are targeting the transformational consumer, people that want to stay healthy. They've moved here to retire early. They want to enjoy their retirement. They want to stay active. But the traditional marketing tools are these demographics versus aspirational aspects of people's lives. How do you find these transformational consumers?
Well, I mean, I actually provide kind of a step-by-step methodology for this in the book. And the thing is, it's not digital at all, right? What I'm suggesting is that we've been trying to solve the disengagement problem with digital tools, and it's actually a very human problem. The challenge is, how do you get people to care about what you sell, right? So what I encourage people to do is to rethink what they actually sell from the perspective of, like, you no longer sell a product or a service. What you sell is a transformation from having some sort of a high-level human problem to no longer having that problem, right? And once you redefine what you sell through the same lens that your customer is looking at it through, you can understand your customer in the most human terms. And so I actually provide in the book, like, a methodology for mapping out your customer's real-world experience of going from having that problem to no longer having that problem. And once you map that customer journey, like, including all of the, like, what they feel and how they act at every stage, what their questions are all along their journey, then you can, it's so funny. It sounds like a very abstract exercise to do, but once you actually put that down on paper, you cannot not see all of the opportunities to reach people. Because you'll see where they're going to look for information about your subject matter.
So this isn't about changing a product to fit a transformational consumer. It's about it's about how to recognize how your product is appealing to this type of consumer. It's all about marketing.
Well, it's both. Like, I run a consumer insights company, and often we're hired by marketers, and often we're hired by product managers or product designers, because they do want to understand customer needs and how they can shift their, especially with a digital product, how you can shift your roadmap to add in more transformational features over time. But you don't, many, many products, like I use in the book, I say, like, okay, there are a couple of products that aren't transformational, a couple, like let's use the acronym ATF, like the Department of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms.
Yeah.
Like, if you sell alcohol, tobacco, or firearms, you probably shouldn't be trying to market them with, like, a healthy, wealthy, wise message to them. But many products that you don't think of as transformational are purchased by the consumer with transformational intent, and many more could be than marketers are marketing that way. So, like, in the book, I actually say, like, maybe garbage bags aren't that transformational. But a couple weeks ago, someone at a speaking engagement, and someone said, hey, I was just doing this big uncluttering project in my house. My goal is to be more productive, to feel like the whole family's energy to lift up. We had a lot of clutter. I was trying to do this in a really smart way, and I went out and bought a bunch of garbage bags. So my garbage bag purchase was actually a transformational purchase. Really, this is about understanding your customers' motivations for buying and tapping into them and activating them, no matter what you sell.
Okay, so say our town, Park City, hired you to consult. Mm-hmm. You know, what we sell is fun. This is a resort town high in the mountains, and we're known for biking in the summer, but especially for skiing in the winter. Obviously, the customer is motivated to get outdoors and exercise and enjoy the great outdoors. But there are, you know, who knows, 50 other winter summer resort towns nearly as famous. We're getting to be one of the top tier towns. But how do we market the Park City recreational product to this half of the population of consumers?
I mean, what I would do is what we always do, which is to start with, what is the business problem we're trying to solve, which sounds like perhaps like differentiation, right? So you might present and say, the question we're trying to answer is, how can we differentiate against all of these other winners?
Yeah, there'd be like a dozen resorts in Utah and far more in the neighboring states, Colorado and in the Sierras.
Sorry, I lost you there a minute. Are you there?
So, yeah, the question is, how do we get people to think of Utah when they think of skiing instead of Colorado or the Sierras?
Yeah. So what I would do is, like, I would do exactly the exercise that I was just talking to you about. I would help Park City redefine kind of what it sells. Maybe what it sells is not fun. Maybe what it sells is, an active way to age, or I'm not sure what the specific thing is, but we would explore what different ways are to understand what Park City sells, what transformation Park City sells. And then we would map out what a real world customer's journey looks like. We would go out and we would talk to a bunch of people, some people who've already been to Park City, some people who are actively choosing to go other places in the winter than Park City. And we would map out their journey of making a decision about where they're going to go in the real world. And we would spot all of the places. We would spot what they do at each stage. We would figure out, like, where they kind of get stuck or puzzled as they're making decisions. We would inventory all the things that trigger them from one stage of the decision-making process to the next. Like, I would just guess, based on what I know about travel, there's probably a point in time where most people who get to the place of making the decision to come to Park City know someone or have read or heard something that showcases all of the best things about Park City. That's probably a big decision trigger for people. And then we would see, where do people go online and off to research winter travel destinations? And based on that, we would probably make some firm recommendations about, like, what content you should create and where you should place it to deliver the sort of core messages that we know trigger people from one stage to the next, and who those people are that you could enlist as influencers, or what those online channels are that you can enlist and use to get people to make this ultimate decision to come to Park City. So it's largely on the marketing side, we often are talking about, like, we're talking about creating content and creating content campaigns and placing the content in strategic places where we know your target audiences are, to move them, their decision, in the direction you'd like them to.
So, Terry.
And sometimes that content is not all about Park City. Like, we might suggest actually helping, working with a third-party travel site or a third-party fitness site. Like, there are a couple of outlets that come to mind for me right now that people aren't often going to for travel information, but they're going to for information on how to live a beautiful, healthy life. That just having your content there might be differentiating by itself, because it's not inundated with travel content. But one key point that I should say is that doing this whole experience and of actually talking to different people empowers you to understand their natural language patterns, your customer's natural language pattern. And that empowers you to create content that really engages and performs at, like, levels that way beat what else is out there on the market. And here's one example of that. When I was at MyFitnessPal, we started this blog there. I started it from zero readers, and we had 10 million readers a month in, like, a 9-month period of time. And one of the reasons our content was so much more engaging than a lot of the other health and fitness content out there was that we were capturing people's the way real people in the world were talking about their fitness issues and their bodies, and we were putting that back into our blog posts and our editorial franchises.
So Tara, let me ask you about MyFitnessPal. I don't know if you heard her open, but I shared an app that I've used for many, many years. Over a period of 3 years, I lost about 50 pounds, in part due to MyFitnessPal, and frankly, in part due to just Park City. It's what people up here do. Mm-hmm. They work out, they're not sitting around watching TV. So it's been a very healthy community for me to be a part of. I'm also a big fan of Under Armour. But I'm curious if my experience and my reaction surprises you, or if there may be a core base where there's other consumers that felt the same way. I love Under Armour. I love MyFitnessPal. But I wasn't happy when, and Kevin Plank's not going to like this comment, but frankly,
he is a part-time Park City person, so you may bump into him in the gym.
Yes, exactly. You know, I love both those brands, but I wasn't happy, and I can't tell you why, when Under Armour bought MyFitnessPal. Was that something that you guys saw coming? Am I an outlier, or do you think that's more common than not?
Let me say this, and I'm going to be a tiny bit more politically correct than I normally am. I have heard this before. I will say that. I have heard this before. There are people, you know, so MyFitnessPal was the MyFitnessPal community of users was roughly, it was mostly female, actually. But more than that, it was mostly people who were on a mission to lose weight, and they were committed to developing nutritional literacy and developing good, healthy habits. That is what our brand is and our content programs are built around. Under Armour's brand is another incredible fitness brand, but it has it just has a different sort of storyline and messaging to it, more about athletic performance. I do think what you saw was these two brands coming together in an effort from the Under Armour perspective to really expand who they were talking to, so that they weren't just talking to and broadcasting to this, like, super, you know, ultra-athletic audience, but just expanding that. And that's part of their growth path as a company. And I definitely do see that transition, and it just takes time. And there's, you know, you got to try stuff, and some of it won't work, and sometimes people won't like it. And then you keep working at it, and you keep iterating on it, and you keep responding to customer feedback. So I honestly think there's still a little bit in that process.
You know, in using your terminology of aspirational, you know, it was my aspiration when I started losing weight was to get to the point where, you know, I was the athlete that you see in the Under Armour commercials, and your framing there actually helped me with why I had that reaction. While I was losing weight, you know, I was part of the group that was working towards coming to this other area, and the two didn't naturally fit together. So that makes a lot of sense. Let's talk about, you know, some other cases where things like that may take place. You have in your book, you talk about these transformational platforms. Companies like Pinterest is an example. Yelp is an example in there. And then you also have a couple others, frankly, that surprised me, like Google is on the list. What are these transformational platforms, and how do you define the companies that, you know, are a natural fit for that?
Yeah. Transformational platforms, in my mind, are just the sort of technology platforms that by platform, I mean that they are content agnostic. They're not dedicated to just health or just getting wealthier or just, you know, self-actualization. They are platforms of technology that are very, very commonly used by transformational consumers to help them reach their goals, whatever their healthy, wealthy, wise goals are. So it is very common for people to use Pinterest to hold the space for the things they want to buy while they're trying to train for a race, and the recipes that they want to cook as they're trying to cook more at home, and, you know, personal finance articles. So people use them all across their efforts. Same with, like, Reddit. Now, I think Reddit is the one that I hear the most surprise about, because Reddit has a reputation for being a community of, for being an uncensored, aggressive internet community. Yeah. But there are a bunch of the subreddit channels that are actually filled with people who are trying to achieve goals. There's a frugality subreddit that is one of the biggest personal finance communities on the internet. Same with fitness, same with minimalism, same with all of these sort of a bunch of efforts to get wiser and to, like, harness wisdom traditions. So yeah, Google is one. You almost can't ignore Google because, listen, as soon as you set a goal to do anything, any aspiration around getting healthier, wealthier, wiser, most people Google it. Most people Google something related to it. And so, and that's just one way in which Google becomes a transformational platform. We use our Google calendars all the time. We use Google to search for new studios and new teachers and new trainers and new courses. We use Google to learn about how to, you know, save money or start a business. You can't really think about technologies that people use in their transformation without thinking about Google.
All right. Well, awesome. Tara, it's been great having you. You open your book saying you've been working on this book since you were 9 years old. You speak very persuasively about the topic. Her book is The Transformational Consumer, Fuel a Lifelong Love Affair with Your Customers by Helping Them Get Healthier, Wealthier, and Wiser. Tara, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks, Tara. Let me get to the forecast here before we bring Steve Hooker from Cushman Wakefield aboard to talk about the commercial property market. It's going to be sunny almost all week, sunny to partly cloudy. It's going to be 42 for a high today. Climbing pretty much all week long, up to 58 by Friday under sunny skies. So looks like a great week for spring corn and, excuse me, all of that good stuff. So Mountain Money will continue after this.
This is Tom Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We are committed to serving Park City and are proud supporters of KPCW. More information at bhhsutah.com or one of our 24 offices throughout Summit and Wasatch counties.
Hi, I'm Davey Ratchford from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain hosts winter events throughout the season, including the annual Torchlight Parade, New Year's Eve celebration, Spring Groove, and more. More information about all Park City Mountain events can be found at parkcitymountain.com.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. We enjoyed our conversation with Tara, and we thank her for joining us. In studio now, we have Stephen Hooker. He is with Cushman & Wakefield Commerce. Stephen, we were talking during the underwriter break that we've heard a rumor here in Park City that there's very, very little commercial real estate open. In fact, the rumor I heard was there's only one spot in Park City, which sounds a little
retailer too... office.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you.
Exactly. Well, it's tight. It's been a very aggressive market for the last 5 years. We've leased up in 2012. We're 10 to 15% in vacancy rates, and right now we're at under 5% vacancy rates. And in office space, we're at 2.5%. Retail, probably 1% vacancy, which means just about everything is gone.
What does that leave you to do then, Steve? If you're a commercial broker, you don't have anything to...
My car drives really well down to Salt Lake. I represent investors with other office buildings, so I take care of about 150 tenants.
Okay. So the city is absolutely red hot, and we've known about that in the residential area and businesses and restaurants and resorts. Everybody... doing well. So what does that leave someone who, let's go to commercial space, who wants to start a business? Do they automatically have to go to where? The Junction or Camas or where?
We have a few choices. I mean, on Main Street in the business district right here, we have probably two or three spaces that are available. They're not inexpensive anymore. The market on Main Street has increased just like everywhere else. It's comparable to business on the ski resorts hill, skier days, or the residential property business. All of it has gone up 40-50% over the last 5 years.
So does that mean if you're on Main Street, you have to be there isn't room anymore, is there, for some mom and pop young couple wants to come in and sell clothing or t-shirts or socks or jewelry? Beyond the point where that kind of a business model works on Maine?
The mom and pop, if they pick their products correctly, probably can survive. But it's a serious business. It's serious incomes. The buildings are worth $3 to $10 million on Main Street. Rents are accordingly. It's, you know, when you have less than 1% vacancy, there's not a problem with renting space. So if you come to do new business, if you do a business model that makes sense, you can actually survive if you do it right.
Well, it makes sense is subjective, right?
It is.
What made sense 5 years ago might not make sense now. Now, the challenge is a lot of the commercial space is probably on 3-year leases or 5-year leases. And then there's a clause where people get to re-up, right? They get right of first refusal. That's usually set to, at some point, it sets to what the market's at. And if I heard you right, the market's up 50% for people that signed their lease 5 years ago. What do those people do?
Well, the 10-year leases, 2006, 2007 leases, were most of those were in the $30 range per square foot. Most of those have raised 2 to 3% per year for cost of living. So right now, most of those leases are at $40 a foot as an average. And right now, if you look at new leases on Main Street, we're between 40 and 60. So there are some adjustments going on. There are some increases going on. But you have to consider if a new buyer bought that building, his rent has been fixed for the last 3, 5, or 10 years. He's doing that adjustment now because the building's increasing value. The rent's increasing.
Yeah, no, it's the economic reality.
It's terrible.
I think the reality is, and we're seeing it, Larry, that there's going to be changes in the business concepts because what worked 10 years ago on Main Street, well-run business, but may not work in the reality of today's new rent rates.
They may not. It depends on how many customers they need. If it's a marketing store, some of the brand name stores are half marketing and half store. So it's like an advertising on the Main Street. Other mom and pops are on there. And I deal with everyone on Main Street constantly on either lease renewals, lease adjustments, abatements. The business right now is just extremely aggressive. It's like any other resort town in the West. We have the same challenges that other resort towns have right now, same type of main streets, and a lot of the same prices.
And one of the fears for the last several years has been that we're losing our individualism because we're getting factory stores in, and our Maine is going to look like every other Maine with a Sunglass Hut next to a Patagonia, next to a some other national franchise that's not really concerned about so much about making money on Main Street as getting their brand before all the people who come to Maine.
It looks that way. It really comes down to the landlord's choice. If they decide to go for national brands, they can charge more money. If they stay with the mom and pops, they take a little less money. It really is the landlord's choice.
Now, so Main Street, not much left. Whole town, not much left. That makes Kimball Junction and Quarry Village the next logical place to site a business. And there are empty storefronts out there. Are they starting to fill?
Very few storefronts available. There's only one space at this time at Quarry.
I walk down the New Park Street and see
New Park's
mostly.
New Park is new. New Park is first generation. It has to be built out. It's a little harder to grow tenants in that location. But one by one, we're leasing space up there. It is about the only space available right now. All of Kimball, there's one space left in Redstone. There is no spaces left at Kimball Plaza. There's no spaces left in front of TJ Maxx. 100% leased up.
So, and let's switch gears and talk about office. You know, there's the city wants to diversify the type of jobs that are available here in Park City. Some of these high tech jobs that have come in, those are nice jobs. But if there's no office space, there's no place for companies to go. And I know there's a new building coming in out at the junction at Kimball. What else should the city be thinking about so that we can continue to attract these good-paying jobs here to Park City?
The Tech Center, Park City Tech Center, has now the second building being completed for the Skullcandy Group. There is 1 million square feet of scheduled property there to be built. The use clauses are very difficult to get passed, so that restricts how many people we can bring into those buildings. That's an area we need to work on. It was all medical and research, and that's pretty hard to fill up in Park City. When we're looking at 1.5% and 2% vacancy, we're basically out of space now. And our office alone has leased probably 45 new companies into Park City over the last 12 months, taking up what was left of the office space. So it's very tight.
I would think there's about to be a bit of a seismic change when Whole Foods moves across the highway to the new location and opens up that huge building, which is probably a driver for all of Redstone for pulling people in. What possible uses could be in the old Whole Foods space that could continue to be an anchor?
I think you're going to see new retail open up there, maybe an office. Just like regular Redstone, it's mixed use. It can be almost anything.
It would take a lot of remodeling, I presume.
It will take remodel, like most, but that's pretty typical in our business.
Yeah. And then what does that do to have a bigger Whole Foods on the other side, which is just near the factory outlet mall?
It's going to make a very fun traffic.
Looking at the mass of the building, and I understand that has, in the employee housing component, which is one of the two buildings under construction there, there's like 18,000 feet of new retail underneath on the first level of that
building. First level retail,
they're
all independent stores, so, and most of those are leased.
Are they? Okay.
So that's what we're hearing from the landlord.
So even Kimball Junction, with the exception maybe of some of the spaces at New Park, even Kimball Junction is full.
It has less than 3 or 4% of vacancy.
So, Stephen, I'm not a real estate guy. I work with a lot of folks that are real estate people. I have some friends that have done very well in real estate as well. And, you know, the caution they always share with me is real estate tends to go in 20-year cycles. And in the good times when things are tight, there tends to be overbuilding taking place. And that's why there's these cycles. Are you fearful of that? Are there plans on the drawing board that you think maybe there's going to be an overreaction to this tightness?
I don't think there's fears of that. I think our cycle in Utah is different than most cycles in the country. We're in the top 10 growth states in the country. We have huge growth in corporate housing. New schools are coming up. Transportation is working. The business attitude in Park City and Utah is extremely good right now. So I'm not sure if those fears are justified. We see cycles, not necessarily a 20-year cycle, but 7 and 8 year financial cycles. And, you know, those things we see all the time. And those are either slight recessions or adjustments, nothing major.
And related to this, in the Salt Lake Trib on Sunday, there was an op-ed about the relocation of the jail and what should be done down there. It's a topic that's in the news. As a real estate expert yourself, what are your thoughts on that big piece of land down by Point of the Mountain? What can the state of Utah do to get the most benefit for the state from that nice, large piece of property that's going to be opened up here pretty soon?
Well, the zoning has changed. It will be residential and mixed-use commercial. The movement of the jail probably goes to a location in the valley that maybe more is suited for the jail. That location by the residences in those towns should be used for residential and commercial.
Yeah, I don't know if either Larry or Steve, if you saw the op-ed piece, the idea there was to kind of pitch a national labs like is down in Sandia. And I thought that was really clever, and I think Utah's in a unique position to do something like that. I don't know as well. I'm signing up saying I think that's a great idea, but I think it's something worth considering.
It'll be very interesting to see what they end up with right there.
So are there any other undeveloped pieces of land either in the basin or between here and the basin or out along Highway 40? Is there plenty of room to just keep expanding almost to infinity in terms of business and office space?
Well, the back Wasatch will expand, as we know, over the next 30, 40 years to probably 500,000 people. So on the Highway 40.
Ouch. I hadn't actually heard that number.
It came from the governor's office a few years ago.
Okay.
But we're growth, just like the desert grew. We're growing on the back Wasatch. The development centers on Highway 40, Quinn's Junction, there's quite a few locations there for future development for retail and mixed use. And those have not been approved yet, but they're on the board.
Okay. Well, thanks for joining us this morning. Steve Hooker with Cushman & Wakefield Commerce, talking about the tight space available in both city limits and elsewhere.
Thank you very much.
In the county. Our pleasure. Well, when we come back, we're going to talk with an entrepreneur who went to some group planning sites, didn't find what he wanted, so he created his own. Blaine Farr's on the line, and we'll be talking to him after this.
All Resort Group is a proud KPCW sponsor of Mountain Money.
All Resort Group provides vans, SUVs, sedans, and Express for Less taxi to move you from Salt Lake to Park City and back, or anywhere you want to go.
Reservations at allresort.com or 649-3999.
We move people.
This is Eric Lee, attorney in the Park City office of Jones Waldo. As a Park City resident for 20 years, I'm proud to support KPCW. Jones Waldo provides legal services to residents of Summit County in many areas. 435-200-0085. JonesWaldo.com.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. We thank Steve for coming in and telling us about the update on commercial real estate.
It's not surprising, I guess, but to know that it's that tight is kind of amazing.
It's good news, bad news, right? It comes with challenges. And speaking of challenges, you know, good advice is when you're going to start a company, you want to make sure you have a real customer's pain. And our next guest developed a product going after customer pain that I can speak to personally because I found out about Blaine Farr, who is our guest. He started a company called WeVite, which lets people send messages to groups of people. I had that problem, and Blaine, I found your company. First off, welcome to Mountain Money, and tell our audience the problem you're trying to help consumers with.
Well, first off, thank you very much. I'm excited to be on the show today. So the problem is one that I've been thinking about for 4 or 5 years. Back 5 years ago, 7 years ago, I guess now, when I was in college, I was the one always organizing our intramural sports teams. So a couple times a week, I'd send out these mass text messages to say, hey, who's coming tonight? You know, you'd have three people respond, and then I'd have to ask again, hey, who's coming? We need this many people. And every single one of those messages is blasted back out to the group, and it lacks any context on, you know, who, what, when, where. You have to search through these annoying group message feeds. And, yeah, that's the pain that I was trying to solve with WeVite, is making it easier for groups to communicate and schedule without those kind of annoying group texts.
Yeah, hey, Blaine, if you're on a speakerphone, can you go off speaker? Your signal is awfully low.
Okay, I apologize for that. We tested it out earlier.
Blaine, let's keep going. So, you know, your app again, you know, I have a vantage point in that I've been using your app for a couple of weeks, and it solved a big pain problem that I had. But share with our audience, it's messaging, but you can do a lot more with your app than you can just by sending a text to different people. What are the various features that your app gives people?
Yes, absolutely. So one of the problems with messaging apps right now is everybody in the group has to install the app for it to be usable by anyone. And one of the cool things about WeVite is it sends a text message to people who have not yet installed the app, and those people can respond by text just by saying in, out, or maybe. And that message doesn't go out to the entire group. It just logs as a yes response. And then when I, the organizer, get in, I can see, I can see everybody who has said in to the event.
Great. And another thing that I like about it is people can actually vote. It makes it easy to decide on different days and times that you're going to get together, which is, as a person that organizes a weekly mountain biking ride, is always difficult getting consensus on when and where do we go.
Yes, absolutely. So as the organizer, I can just put in, hey, here are three times that I think will work for the group, and everybody in the group can respond. And instead of that creating 20 messages in a group text that everybody gets, it's just one notification where I, the organizer, can see what time works best for everybody.
So how did this come about? There's kind of a funny story on your website that it came about through your frustrations over over these sites, but it really came about because your wife gave you permission to quit your job and start this from scratch. That's a pretty risky thing to do.
Yes, it certainly is. So a couple weeks after our last child was born, I was looking to get our other child out of the house and get some friends together to go play disc golf. So I invited 10 friends to say, hey, who can go play disc golf in the morning? We can take the kids. That's a beautiful morning. And I sent out that group text, and I got, I think, 7 no responses on a no, 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 no. And then 2 people never responded. I thought, man, A, I feel dumb for having annoyed everybody. B, everybody in that group just got, 6 no messages that they did not need to receive. And, C, I still wanted to go play disc golf, and the people that I'd invited couldn't go. And that was the final trigger. And you know what? There's nothing out there that really makes this easy for me. And that is the point that I, started building some prototypes, mocking things up, and asked my wife very late that night if we could do this. And she said yes.
So you had a couple challenges going for you there. One is, you were leaving a really nice career. You had spent several years at Sorensen Capital. And you were also involved, I believe, just before you left with Lucid Chart, which is headed up by a Park City resident, Carl's son. How did you make that's a high-risk thing to say, I'm going to leave this great job to go do a startup. How did you think about that process?
Yeah, good question. So I did stay at Lucid for quite a while I was concurrently building the app. And fortunately, because of those jobs, we'd built up a reasonable savings that we could dip from a little bit. And I also felt like I had employable skills where if this did not work out, I'd be able to jump back into the workforce and find other opportunities. So then the other bargaining chip that I had with my wife is a couple years ago, we'd been planning on going to business school. And as I was evaluating the decision to go to business school and incurring $400,000, $500,000 of lost opportunity cost savings, this was much smaller in comparison. And that was kind of the last chip on, we've saved all this extra by choosing not to go to business school. This is something that I think would be a great learning opportunity and potentially a great business opportunity. So let's go after this hard for a period of time.
Okay. I have a hard time with some of these software startups, app startups, understanding where the revenue comes from. What's the business model that flows cash into your company?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are several components to the revenue model here. One is we allow users to discover nearby events, concerts, deals, and things to do with their groups. And anytime something is purchased, we make about 10% on that transaction. So let's say that your biking group wanted to buy tickets to a BMX event down in Salt Lake. We would get 10% off any tickets that are bought that way. Additionally, we are adding in some premium group functionality. So if you want a group above 50 users, you'd have to pay a small amount to be able to send messages out to that group because it's above a certain size. We also have plans for additional public groups and public events where you could pay to feature things to do around you. So mixing people don't spend money on apps, but they spend billions on experiences, group dining experiences and things to do.
Yeah, no, the app space is tough. And Larry, what Blaine's saying is Doug's not going to be able to use this app for free forever.
Your group under 50.
that's the sign of a true pain, though, for the user is when they're actually willing to bring out their credit card. And in my situation, it's either pay, whatever the fee's going to be, 99 cents a month for this app, or send out 7, 8, 9 texts to communicate to the whole group, which is frankly a really a hassle for me. Blaine, we've only got a couple minutes left. You know, I talked about the challenge of making the decision to leave Lucid, and I think your explanation of doing both jobs for a period of time is really good advice. We also have a lot of people in the audience that have great app ideas, but they're not technical. They're not programmers. They're not coders. And I know you went to a coding boot camp, but we're not really a top-tier coder. Talk to us about how you bridge that gap for your company.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think any technical startup, you need to have a product person who can communicate with the engineers. So obviously, this is not relevant if you are an engineer and you're looking to start your own company. But if you're non-technical, I really think it's important that you can at least speak the language, that you can communicate with engineers, that you understand their process and their workflows and how to define what needs to be done, or else there can be an immense amount of time and capital wasted on iterating over and over on a poorly scoped project. So that has been a key part, I think, to helping us be successful to this date is, you know, me being able to find those engineers, them having confidence in me because I can speak their language, because of the amount of work that, you know, I did before engaging them. And I can't imagine doing it without that experience and those skills.
Yeah, no, I applaud you for going to the coding boot camp. As you know, I did something similar a couple years ago. And it's very important that you may not be a coder as a living, but you need to be fluent in it for all the reasons that Blaine just shared. Blaine, unfortunately, we need to run. Our guest has been Blaine Ferrer. He is a young entrepreneur here in Utah. You're going to hear more about him in the future, I'm sure. His app is called Wevyte, Wevyte. It's available on Android and iPhones. Check it out on the various platforms or Wevyte.com. Blaine, thank you for coming in.
Yep, thank you very much, Dave.
Okay, thanks, Blaine. And we will be back to wrap up Mountain Money.
This is Ryan Hoffman, manager at Mountain West Bank, sponsor of KPCW. We're a community bank with a great understanding of our local needs. Mountain West Bank has something unheard of nowadays, but I can't say it on the radio. We're next to the movies near Kearns Boulevard at 649-3369. Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Cookies on Fridays.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
You know, Doug, in Silicon Valley, there was all the so many of those early companies had the a story that they were started in a garage. Initially, I think we're headed that way in Park City
because it doesn't the only place you can get space.
It doesn't sound like there's hardly any place to
you know what's
set
funny,
up
Larry,
a business
was,
or an office.
Was your sense that it was that type before Steve came in?
No, not really, but. Come
it
to think of
like,
it.
It seems like there's space, but like you, I'm come to think of it.
Come to think of it, I don't see those signs anymore for lease. There is a small space over at Silver Mountain Sports Club. I did see a sign there.
You know,
but
I think there's always going to be small spaces, but I think a challenge for the city is going to be getting the bigger spaces in for bigger employers that we're thankful for. I also want to take a minute and thank our great sponsors of Mountain Money. They include Mountain West Bank, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, Jones Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough, All Resort Express, Park City Mountain and Apex Residences, and Viridian Park City, Columbus Pacific Properties.
And let's thank our guest, Tara Nicole Nelson, with the Transformational Consumer, Steve Hooker with Cushman Wakefield Commerce, and Blaine Farr from Wevyte. And you know, Doug, we donate these books to the Park City Library, so sometimes you can find books that we've talked about on air there. Well, that's it for Mountain Money. Thanks for joining us. This is KPC.